It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, our guest says pursuing your dreams shouldn't be a choice between your day job and your passion.
First, the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals in Virginia upheld an earlier court's decision to block President Trump's revised travel and immigration ban, which bars people from six Muslim-majority countries from coming to the United States.
The earliest version of the ban sparked protests nationwide and was quickly blocked by courts throughout the country. And when the revised ban came out in March, it was blocked by federal courts hours before it was set to go into effect.
Javed Kalim is with us to talk about the ruling. He's the national race and justice reporter at the LA Times. Javed, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, what was the reasoning given in this appeals court decision to uphold this block of the travel ban?
The appeals court, the majority of the judges said that the president was acting, and they used these words, quote, bad faith, when he signed the travel ban. And they very explicitly said that Donald Trump's quotes about the travel ban and during his campaign about banning Muslim immigration, suspending it, were clear indications of his intention to discriminate against a religion, Muslim people, with the travel ban. And they said that's against the law, against the Constitution.
Right. They said that amounted to a First Amendment violation. Is that right?
Yes.
And what was the vote? What was the 10-3 was that?
Yes, so there were 13 judges in the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals of Virginia, in Richmond, Virginia, and 10, all of whom were appointed by Democratic presidents, voted in the majority opinion to rule against travel ban. And the three in the minority who were Republican presidential appointees said that the president, they dissented. They said the president has wide authority over national security and immigration, and this is what he was doing, and there's no indication in the text of the travel ban as it's worded right now that he intends to discriminate against Muslims. So it broke down by party lines, basically.
We'll dig further into some of those arguments, but right now, what is the status of the travel ban? It just isn't in effect at all, is that right?
It isn't, you know. We've had two iterations of the travel ban, one signed January 27th and one signed in March. And continuously, one after the other, both were blocked. So, you know, the one that was initially signed in January was in effect for maybe, you know, two-ish days when we saw protests at airports around the country and people detained before boarding flights internationally, as well as when they got into the country, and lots of chaos. But since then, it just has been a no-go.
This is the appeals court. Is this expected to go to the U.S. Supreme Court now?
The travel ban issue is going to is very likely to go to the U.S. Supreme Court. Now, will this case specifically? It's unclear yet. The Department of Justice said yesterday that it rejects the reasoning in this ruling, and it will appeal to the highest court, but the court still has to say, okay, we'll hear you out. And the court could very well say, we're okay, and that means the lower court decision stands. But there is also a second travel ban case in a different appeals court in San Francisco, the Ninth Circuit, that is pending. They heard arguments over the a similar block nationally of the travel ban early this month. And they are also ruling, or expected to rule, on a block of the 120-day ban on new refugee resettlements. So that case should be decided soon, and that could also go to the Supreme Court. So it's likely something will be decided at the highest court. And the highest court, now with Neil Gorsuch in office, not an office per se, but as a judge, is divided and leans toward Republicans or conservatives.
Talking to Javed Kalim from the LA Times, looking at the travel ban, the travel and immigration executive order from the White House, blocked in courts, that block affirmed by an appeals court just yesterday, expected to go to the Supreme Court. Now, Javed, this was the big story when the executive orders first came out. A lot of other news has happened since then. Remind us, if this were to go into effect, what would change?
So if this was to go into effect, there are people who are citizens of six countries in the Middle East who would not be allowed to get visas to come to the U.S. For a period of 90 days. During that 90 days, and these are all predominantly Muslim countries, where the government says that there are signs that there is terrorism there, or terrorism could be imported to the U.S. So there'd be a 90-day block on folks in those countries, and then there'd be a 120-day block on new refugee resettlement. And in that time period, 90 and 120 days, 3 months, 4 months, the travel ban says that the U.S. government will review its procedures, its vetting standards, and figure out, you know, how to better secure the nation from extremism and terrorism. And it has the option in the travel ban to extend that period. That 90 days could be 4 months, 5 months, 6 months. It has that option.
The argument in this court case, at least, as you've touched on already, seems to be the president and his supporters saying this is a national security issue, and the judges who have ruled against it saying this is a religious discrimination issue. For that latter point, religious discrimination, you mentioned they've pointed to the president's campaign statements talking about banning Muslims. And it seems like there's been debate in these cases over whether judges should be considering those campaign statements at all. Has that been a big part of the argument?
That's been the central point of the argument, actually. In oral arguments in court, lawyers for the Trump administration and those fighting against the travel ban have gone back and forth saying, you know, just listen to this guy and listen to what he said. He said, suspend Muslim immigration. He said, I think Islam hates us. He said, you know, when he signed the new travel ban and it was blocked, he said, well, I like the first one anyway. It was a watered-down version of what I wanted to do. So it's been, you know, Donald Trump's quotes have been the primary citation in these cases, and that's highly unusual. Usually, you know, and judges have said this who have dissented and who have actually ruled against the ban have said, well, usually campaign statements are kind of loose. People say things, they're meant to be general ideas, but not specific formulations of what they want to do in office. But in this case, judges have said that he just went too far, and he didn't just stop after his campaign. He kept on going once he was president and in that period between winning and becoming president.
And then dissenting judges have said, in effect, the president has more or less no questions asked authority over letting people into the country when it comes to issues of national security. Are we expecting to see that argument when this comes before the Supreme Court?
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's true. The law in terms of immigration and national security gives the president wide powers, especially on security issues. And you know, the government has made the argument that well, the president and the administration have data and intelligence and records on where the threats are, and they made their choices about who to temporarily suspend in the country based upon that information. It's going to be a central point. Does the president get to do what he wants in immigration and refugees, or do we have to really kind of scrutinize his moves?
Do we have any kind of timeline as to when this could go before the Supreme Court?
Well, the term is coming up for the court. You know, the clock is ticking down. So it could happen this spring. It could happen relatively soon. And considering the urgency with which both sides in these cases have treated the travel ban, and they've rushed these cases through the court system, through multiple courts, because they've said it's a matter of people's life and their safety and their well-being and such that it's likely the highest court would hear them rapidly.
Javed, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Javed Kaleem is national race and justice reporter for the LA Times. He joined us today to talk about the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals continuing to block President Trump's travel and immigration executive order. Right now, we've all heard the phrase, don't quit your day job, but our next guest really means it.
New York Magazine columnist Brad Stahlberg joins us now. He's also the author of the upcoming book, Peak Performance. In his recent article, he lays out the argument that pursuing your dreams shouldn't be a choice between your day job and your passion. Brad, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So, Brad, what happens when we have a day job, something we feel like we should do, maybe to pay the bills and put food on the table, and something we feel that we must do? There's no other choice but to do it. How do we go about handling that disconnect?
So there are two ways to go about handling it. In one way, which is kind of the prevailing wisdom, at least at lots of commencement speeches, is quit your day job and follow your passion, and you'll lead a more fulfilling life doing, like you said, what you feel like you must do or fulfilling your calling. Paradoxically, it turns out that perhaps the better way to pursue your calling or what you feel like you must do or what you must be doing is actually to do so on the side. So stay in your day job and follow your passion incrementally on the side.
It seems counterintuitive, doesn't it? I mean, maybe we over-romanticize the idea of just going for your dreams in American culture, but it does seem like, why would you want to keep that day job when you could just go all in on something else?
So what researchers have found is that when people keep their day job, it actually allows them to take more risks and be more creative in pursuing their passion. And if you think about it, it kind of makes sense, right? If you quit the day job and all of a sudden you need an income and you need to do it by following your quote-unquote passion, you might not be able to really pursue it to the fullest because you'll be risk-averse and you'll be cautious. Whereas if you have that day job to fall back on, it really allows you to take more risks. And the example that I like to give is myself as a writer. Is I've incrementally had more of my income come from writing, writing being my passion, I've kept my day job. And what it's let me do is instead of pitching and writing articles that I might not want to write but that will pay well, it's allowed me to take more shots at writing more provocative stories and maybe writing fewer stories but more meaningful ones, knowing that I'm not completely reliant on it for an income.
So I guess the idea is there's something psychologically beneficial about feeling a little safe.
Absolutely.
So why is that? Why do we think that, you know, there's not something? I mean, it seems like it could go the other way, that it could be damaging to think that you were holding out on yourself. Why does being safe help us?
So, you know, humans, the species, right? We evolved to kind of protect ourselves, and that's our whole fear mechanism. So I would make the argument that it's really in our DNA to feel fear and to have fear hold us back. And I think, well, on the one hand, like you said, paradoxically, certainly keeping your job, you could say that is fear holding you back. But on the other hand, if you quit that job, then for most people, unless you're really, truly bulletproof and someone that thrives under pressure, the fear factor actually gets higher. And therefore, like I said, you're probably less likely to really take the shots that will let you do what you want to do.
Now, part of what plays into this whole idea is something called the barbell strategy. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so the barbell strategy is something that an author named Nassim Taleb referenced in his book. It's a great book. It's called Anti-Fragile. And what he says is that the best way to make a big life change or a career change is to think about it like a barbell. And on the one end of the barbell, you have the safe bet or something that is fairly risk-averse. It could be the job as the accountant. On the other end of the barbell, you have the 1 in 100 shot, but you're going to, you know, if it hits, you're going to be thrilled. And he calls it the dichotomy between having the accountant on one end of the barbell and the rock star on the other. And what he says is the best way to become a rock star is to be an accountant while you're becoming a rock star versus to quit your job and try to become a rock star.
So there's some research, as you were talking about, behind this. On the other hand, you know, we get a lot of messages to the contrary in our culture. And I think it was not too long ago, maybe a couple of years back, that Anderson Cooper, the TV host, made waves by saying, you know, you shouldn't have a plan B because then you're not all in on your dream. And I think a lot of people buy that and think it makes sense. Are we overdoing it on the go for your dream stuff?
Well, like I said, I think that there's individual variation, and I think that some people probably truly do thrive under pressure, and for those people, it might make sense to go all in. But what the research shows is that entrepreneurs that keep their current day job, even if it feels like they're going through the motions in it, while they build out their business on the side, they have something like a 33% greater chance of success in actually standing up that business and having it be sustainable in the future. So what I'd say the research says, and the argument isn't that you should always keep the day job, but rather than completely jump ship and go all in, a more incremental approach probably works best for a lot of people, and the research would support that.
We're talking right now with Brad Stulberg. He's a columnist for New York Magazine, and we've been talking about his recent article that says pursuing your dreams shouldn't be a choice between your day job and your passion. You can do both. In fact, some research shows that we're more successful when we keep that day job and at the same time go for those dreams. And you can find that article over on the Central Time Facebook page. And we want to hear from you. Is this something that you've seen in your own life? Did you have a brass ring kind of life you wanted and you didn't quite give up the day job, but you eased into that that brass ring dream job? Or did you go for it? Did you go all in? And how did that work out? You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Brad, is there more research like this out there that a more measured approach can help us when we're trying to launch a life and a career?
So I think that, you know, it's not a widely evaluated area and it could probably use some more research. Anecdotally, I've had the privilege to spend a lot of time around world-class athletes and have done a lot of reporting with world-class athletes. And somewhat similarly, what tends to happen is the individuals that don't specialize early, so maybe they play a bunch of sports growing up, or maybe they actually spread out their interests, right? They pursue arts, more intellectual pursuits, music, and athletics at the same time. Those are the athletes that actually tend to attain world-class status, which is kind of counterintuitive because mm-hmm. you think it would be those athletes that go completely all in right off the bat, but that's not the case.
Well, how come we don't know about those athletes? I mean, I've heard of Venus and Serena Williams. Everybody knows that they played tennis practically from the womb, and we think about them as being the pinnacle of the sport. Well, is it something that we're not getting, that other narrative?
Yeah, I think so. You know, a recent statistic is in the recent NFL football draft, something like 29 or 28 of the first 31 picks all played multiple sports growing up. And I think what ends up happening in the athletic world is you raise a good point, but I think there's a lot of selection bias. So we hear the story of Venus and Serena or of Tiger Woods per se, but what we don't hear is of all the kids that burnt out because they were so obsessive and focused on that one thing from a young age. And that's just not as attractive or inspirational of a story to tell. But when you look at the research, what you find is that that kind of over-specialization, it does tend to lead to burnout, at least in athletes.
Let's take a caller now. We've got Scott joining us in Toma. Scott, hi.
Hi. How are you?
Good, thanks. What do you want to share?
Well, I had an unusual experience where I used to be a special education teacher, worked full-time. I had a student come to me and basically called me a hypocrite because he said I wasn't following my dreams. And so basically just to, you know, see if he was right or not, I went and started playing a little bit part-time on the side while I was teaching. And I got lucky. I got on the Oprah Winfrey Show. I thanked 45 million people. And you know, but I didn't quit cold turkey right away. I took a part-time job, and I did that for a couple years. And about 5 years ago, I went full-time. That's all I do now. And I've been on a Super Bowl commercial, and it's been fantastic. But I totally agree with him in that you don't have to completely quit cold turkey in order to follow your passions. But I do admit that in the last 5 years, had I not made the decision to finally quit that part-time job, I wouldn't have put my all into this. So.
Wow, Scott, what a story. I can't believe that you started out, you got on Oprah, you've been on commercials. So you're agreeing with our guests that you can go kind of part-time in the beginning, but do you think that the ultimate goal is to do it, you know, full time, and that's eventually where the road leads?
I definitely knew that when I started this, when I took that part time job, that was just going to be a temporary thing, and that my goal was to put my all into the music. And it was hard too. I mean, I even said this when I was on Oprah. You know, one of the things that, you know, I've been told my whole life is that music is a hobby. Don't quit your day job. I mean, that's literally a phrase that everybody hears when it comes to music. I'm one of the few exceptions that can say that, you know, you work hard enough, you put your effort into it, and if you're good enough, you can make a full-time income from it. So.
Oh, that's inspiring. Scott, thanks a lot for calling and for sharing your story. And Brad, what do you think about that? Well, what do you hear in Scott's story there?
So I think Scott's story is a really nice example of what the research shows and what I wrote in that article, which is just that I think a more incremental approach to following your passion is the way to go. You know, it's interesting that Scott said at a certain point he did feel like he had to go all in. And I couldn't agree more. I think that is the goal. And of course you want to get to a point where you can really be doing what you love the whole time. But it was also really interesting to hear Scott note that he took on a part-time job for those first few years as he was making progress. And I'd wonder if he hadn't had that part-time job, would he have been able to take the shots that ultimately got him on the Oprah Winfrey Show and enabled him to do this full-time?
Scott, well, thanks so much for calling. And Brad, final words of advice. What do you want people to know if they're stuck in something that's not really their first choice and they want to get there? What should they do?
So I think that I would identify what really makes you tick and what you really want to do and also be practical about it. Not everyone can be an NBA basketball player. Very few people can. But come up with a practical gig that you think would really be fulfilling and make you tick, and then figure out an incremental path to get there. So have it start as a hobby, and then maybe try to go down to 90% at your job. Or in Scott's case, shift jobs is something that allows you to work part-time. But I would recommend not just diving all in unless you really know that you're someone that thrives under pressure.
Brad, thanks a lot for talking today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Brad Stolberg. He's a columnist for New York Magazine. We've been talking about a recent piece he wrote that says pursuing your dreams doesn't have to be about going all in. You can take baby steps and get there eventually. And you can find that article on the Central Time Facebook page.
First, as people gear up for Memorial Day around the state, the unofficial start of the summer also means that people will start dusting off their grills to kick off grilling season.
And on this week's Food Friday, we'll get smart advice about how to make the best barbecue when you fire up the grill from a dad and a daughter who've been barbecuing together for years.
We've got Mike Mills with us now, champion pitmaster, head of the 17th Street Barbecue in Murfreesboro, Illinois. Mike, welcome to the show.
Well, I'm happy to be here.
And also with us is daughter Amy Mills. She grew up with barbecue as a barbecue consultant herself, and their new cookbook is Praise the Lard, Recipes and Revelations from a Legendary Life in Barbecue. Amy, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having us.
Well, Mike, you're a legend in the barbecue world, but how did you get started? How did you become a pitmaster?
Well, just by barbecuing, actually. I grew up by... standing in the crib, looking out the window, watching my dad barbecue in the backyard. And that was just something that he did weekly, and all the neighbors would bring food in, and he would cook for all of them, you know, plus for the family. And it's just something that I have done all my life, and even after my father passed, I mean, all his brothers were barbecuers. As a family, would get together on the weekends. It's just been something we've done in a family affair.
So is there still a lot of family knowledge that goes into what you do today?
Yes, I would say that there is, because each one was very verbal and had their opinion and were free to give it. But, you know, and as each one would practice, and there's always a barbecue is a controversial type food anyway, of how you prepare it and how you do it and the results that you happen to get. Each person has their own trade secrets, so to speak.
And Amy, reading your book, it's not just about the food. Part of the story here is about family and community and bringing people together, isn't it?
Absolutely. I think a barbecue restaurant is the town hall and the kind of the community seat of a place. And we have learned over the years, as people have traveled from all over the world on a daily basis to visit us, they're certainly coming for barbecue, but they're also coming for community, and they're really wanting to be part of our family. And once they've been here and, you know, sat around our fire and eaten in our restaurant and bellied up to our vintage bar, you know, it feels like home, and they keep coming back again and again.
What do you think it is, Amy, about barbecue in particular that lets all that stuff you just described happen that maybe wouldn't happen if you were, you know, the owner of a French bistro?
I think it has something to do with fire. Fire is just this very primal thing. You know, people are always drawn to a hearth or to a fire. We have a fire pit outside, and people always stop and gather there for a little bit. And, you know, barbecue is very personal. There are no two barbecues that are the same. You know, John Shelton Reed, the well-known North Carolinian barbecue historian, has likened it to the wine in France. If you drive 20 miles, the flavor changes. And I think that's very true about barbecue. And so people come, you know, sometimes they're looking for a taste from home. Sometimes they're thinking, oh, well, that's, you know, that barbecue's pretty good. Not as good as mine or not as good as my daddy made, but it's pretty good. And once they think that or say that to us, we know we've done our job. If you can come in first or come in second or third to somebody else's favorite barbecue, you're winning, I think. But there's just something uniquely American about barbecue. I think it really is one of our original cuisines and our, you know, our original soul and comfort food, and people just flock to it.
Mike, tell us about some of your favorite flavors and spices. What are the key things you like to work with?
Well, of course, pork is probably the most flavorful flavor that you can have out there, you know, that people barbecue with. But the hot item right now is brisket. Nationwide, the brisket is the special flavor profile.
And yeah, and you've got a lot of. I wanted to get into some of the spices. You've got a lot of rubs and sauces in there. What kind of flavors do we want to get on our brisket and on our ribs?
Well, of course, you have the pepper. I'm going to tell you we put a lot of dry rub on it. As far as I call it a dry rub. It's garlic, you know, garlic granular, the pepper, the mustard, mustard slather that's on there. When you get a combination of all these items, it really adds flavor.
On brisket especially, too, you know, we use an 18-mesh grind pepper, and it really mellows out in the cooking process, but it gives it just that, it melds with the juiciness and with all the flavorful fat in beef and really gives it a big, bold taste. You know, you need something that's a little bit heavier to stand up to brisket. But on our ribs, Daddy, you should tell them about the magic dust, the pure magic.
Magic dust. I like the sound
of
that.
And that shows up a lot in your cookbook.
Yes, it does.
Well, the magic dust, without it, you just couldn't have barbecue. But it's a combination of spices that, of course, originally has salt, pepper, red pepper, garlic granular, onion granular. There's actually about 18 different spices, and it's all in very few denominations, and it lends to anything that your taste buds might be drawn to. And I've noticed that over a period of time, depending on what a person, how their taste buds are as to what they pick out of the spice of the barbecue rub. Some flavors they'll never detect because, for whatever reason, their mouth does not taste those items.
Wow.
It's there, but they don't really realize what that is because it's not something that they can definitely pick out.
And can you make kind of a big vat of that magic rub and then just keep it around for your grilling for a month or so?
Yes, we do that. We make it by the 100 pounds at a time.
But at home, you can definitely make it, you know, a few cups at a time, and it will keep, especially if you use fresh spices, you know, a good 6 months or more. You can even keep it in the freezer. The recipe that we provide in the book, and in the book, you know, this is a derivation of our magic dust called Pure Magic, and that recipe makes about 2 1/4 cups. We use it on everything. It's good on French fries. It's good on popcorn. You know, my dad jokingly says it's good on everything but ice cream.
It's not good on ice cream. I tried it.
You tried it. You put it to the test. That's great.
Yes.
We're talking to Mike Mills and Amy Mills. Their new cookbook is Praise the Lard, Recipes and Revelations from a Legendary Life in Barbecue. Well, you mentioned recipes. We've got a couple of your recipes on the Central Time Facebook page and at WPR.org. And, you know, I'm not a big brisket guy, but I do love ribs. And I got to say, I'm not very good at grilling a mic. Can you tell me, basic level, what's going to make me better at grilling some ribs?
Turn your heat down.
That's a big part of where I go wrong, I think, yeah.
Yes, most people do it too hot. Their fire is too hot. Try to get it to where you can have a fire that is manageable, and you really... most times it is on the hot side. It's going to burn quickly. Those are very fragile. The ribs are very fragile. And I normally have a heat index of around 200, 210, basically never over 225. When you start getting up higher than that, then it's hard to control. And the more you mess with them and try to cool that down and try to get it back to where it should be, it seems like the hotter it will get.
And that's a rule of thumb in your book. You say try to cook at the lowest temperature that you can get away with. And I think that surprises a lot of people who think you want to sear it and char it and get it done fast.
Absolutely. And that is, in my personal opinion, that's where they make a mistake, is trying to do. Ribs are very fragile. They're not very thick, you know. And you gotta kind of baby them along a little bit. And, you know, you don't want to keep flipping them and drying them out. The more times you turn the meat, the more it will dry out. And that's a fact on any piece of meat that you happen to be cooking. The more times you turn it, the more the drier it's going to be. No matter what it happens to be that I am aware of it, you know, I don't care if it was an egg. You keep turning it, you're going to dry it out. So therefore, cut your heat down a little bit to where it's manageable. You're not fighting the heat all the time. You're not fighting the that part of it to where that you can have time to let it soak in and cook evenly all the way through.
And Amy, is this ribs a good place to use that magic dust?
Absolutely. That magic dust is delicious on all kinds of pork. It's good on beef too, but really, I think it really shines on pork.
We're talking with Mike and Amy Mills right now on this week's Food Friday. Their new cookbook is called Praise the Lard, Recipes and Revelations from a Legendary Life in Barbecue.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about barbecuing? Do you have a mistake you make again and again? They can maybe help you solve it. Do you have some tips and secrets of your own to share with us? Call in now at 800-642-1234. Oh, yeah. What's going on the grill this weekend for you? 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll pick up our conversation in just a little bit here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And we're continuing our conversation about how to kick up our barbecuing technique with Mike and Amy Mills. They're the co-authors of the new book called Praise the Lard, Recipes and Revelations from a Legendary Life in Barbecue. And they run the famous 17th Street Barbecue in Murfreesboro, Illinois.
You can join the conversation now at 800-642-1234. Do you need grilling advice? Maybe for something you're planning on grilling this weekend, or do you have a secret, a strategy of your own, a favorite crowd pleaser? And what do you like about barbecue? Do you bring people together? Do you make it a community, neighborhood, family event when you fire up the grill? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post and find a couple of recipes from our guests on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Amy, what do you have to have on the side when you've got some tremendously tasty barbecue on the table? Maybe you've got your brisket or your baby back ribs. What needs to go alongside all that?
Well, we think that barbecue sides are equally as important as the meat, and we take great care in preparing those, and we've provided some of our very favorite recipes in this book. One of our most popular is our tangy pit beans. And they are unusual in that we have four or five different types of beans, and they're both sort of savory and sweet at the same time with a lot of different spices. We put some honey in there. We put some of our Pure Magic dry rub. They really have a lot of different textures and flavors, and I think they really hold up well to all of the flavors in the meat.
We've got a recipe for that actually linked again on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to a caller now at 800-642-1234. Al is with us in Eau Claire. Al, hi.
Hi, how you doing? I got a quick question. I got like a cheaper grill. I think what I want to do is, should I get a grill with like the flip-open grate to add more coals to keep my cooking time longer? Or can I get away with lifting up the grate and throwing in more coals, or am I going to throw a lot of ash everywhere?
Al, thanks for the call. Mike, any advice?
Yes, whenever you're messing with your coals, sometimes people think it takes a lot more coals than what it actually takes to create the amount of heat that you need. Adding them very slowly, you know, using a good charcoal, one that is not full of... I don't know what I want to call them.
Like chemicals or?
Yeah, full of chemicals, full of other...
Fillers.
Dirt filler, something. But, you know, and you can use either a charcoal that is solid charcoal. It's the only thing in it is some cornstarch to help hold it together. But don't add so much. Don't get it so hot and try to go for so long. Add just a little bit as you go along in order to keep a small fire. It doesn't take much to have a 200 to 225 degree temperature, and especially depending upon the grill that you have in your backyard. It's hard to tell you exactly how much, but I'm going to tell you a double handful of coals. Turned off gray is a lot of heat.
Well, Al, I hope that helps. Good luck with your barbecuing there. As we talk with Mike Mills, champion pitmaster, and Amy Mills, Mike's daughter, and they run the 17th Street Barbecue together, and they co-authored the new book we're talking about today called Praise the Lard, Recipes and Revelations from a Legendary Life in Barbecue. And you can call us with your questions, your favorite recipes, any tricks you have, family, ingredients, recipes for your favorite barbecue. Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let us know if you've already had your first grill out of the season. Maybe you never stop. Some people do it year-round. What about the two of you? Are you year-round? You do it at your restaurant, but do you do it outside, even in the winter months?
Absolutely. There is no season for barbecue. And I think, obviously, the media always has a barbecue and grilling season in the summer, but really I think it's a year-round sport these days.
Mike, I wanted to ask you about adding wood to the grill. What kind of wood can we add to add flavor to a brisket or a ribs?
You know, any barbecue wood that's, when I say barbecue wood, whatever flavor, I'm just not big on certain ones that put off a very strong, like a mesquite, this type thing. But one of the best, I use apple. It has a skin instead of a heavy bark. If you use a heavy barked wood, your meat is going to darken. It's going to blacken on you. If you use the inside wood of any variety, whether it happens to be oak, pecan, I use a lot of pecan. I think that it's really a great wood. Any other type of wood, just use it a little at a time. You don't need great amounts of wood. Also, I would say that if you are using something with a bark on it, try to use as much inside rather than the bark, because it will darken. There's not much you can get away from on certain things. It doesn't make any difference if it turns black, but it's just not as pretty.
All right. Well, thank you for that advice there about the wood. And let's take a call. We've got Bob from Lake Navacagan. Am I pronouncing that right, Bob? I've seen that lake my whole life, and I don't know if I ever heard anyone say it out loud.
Lake Navacagan.
Ah, Lake Navacagan. All right. Tell us, Bob, what's your question?
I got a comment. I fixed a lot of my grilling problems by getting a pellet grill. They're wonderful, and they got like 20 different types of pellets, flavors. And the question is, how do you get barbecue sauce to stick to chicken?
That's a good question. All right. Thank you, Bob, and thanks for that pronouncer for me. And Amy or Mike, I don't know who wants to field that one. What do you think?
I think that our barbecue sauces actually are very thin. We apply them in several coats right before we take the meat off the pit. And we're really wanting, you know, when you eat barbecue, we think you should taste three or four different flavors. You should taste a kiss of smoke, not over-smoked. You should taste the meat itself and be able to tell what kind it is. You should taste some spice in the form of the dry rub or any, the seasoning that you use. And then, you know, the tangy flavor of the sauce. And all of those things in perfect proportion make that rodeo in your mouth and that really delicious barbecue. So we are not huge fans of thick barbecue sauce that stays on chicken. We really like to layer several thin coats near the end, let it dry, add another coat, and we think that provides a really nice amount of barbecue sauce. You can always add more on the plate, too, if you really like that sauce.
Oh, nice.
I hope that helps.
Yeah, that's great. Thanks, Amy.
And, Mike, that reminds me, you make a strong case for if we're using a soda or ketchup or anything, you want us to use ones with cane sugar, not high-fructose corn syrup. You taste the difference between them.
I taste the difference, and also just health-wise, it's a better product all the way around if you'll use that, yes.
And as we get going here into grilling season, what's something new do you think that we should be trying to kick up our barbecuing to the next level that maybe, you know, we haven't done? What do you think?
I think fruit is a really great thing to grill. You can eat it on its own. You can squeeze the juices and make cocktails. You'll see that we have a whole chapter on cocktails in the book, and we heavily utilize some grilled fruit in those things. And fruit in barbecue sauce, I think, is very popular these days as well. While we love the traditional flavors, it's fun to experiment with some new things as well.
And, Mike, as we wrap up, I mean, you do this professionally, obviously, at the restaurant all over the country. Do you still host a fun family or neighborhood barbecue at home, even though it's your day job, too?
Believe it or not, I do. I love doing it. I love the people. I love to be around the barbecue. I just like the live fire that comes off of it and the way it slows life down.
Why do you think it does that? Why do you think it slows life down?
I think that we all get to thinking about the camaraderie between the people, and we're not worried about all the daily details. I mean, the conversations that go on around a fire are not normally about the politics and all of that. It's just about life in general and the kids and the family and this type of thing that happens at nighttime with that fire going on, or even daytime too, but a lot of times it's at night or late evening. And I think the conversation is just completely different than it is on a daily basis.
That's a great place to leave it. Mike, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having us, and happy barbecuing to everyone out there.
And Amy, thanks to you as well. Thanks.
It was such a pleasure. Thank you.
We've been talking to Mike Mills and Amy Mills, father and daughter team, long history of barbecue, especially at the 17th Street Barbecue in Murfreesboro, Illinois. They've helped open barbecues in New York City, all over the country, really. Their new cookbook is called Praise the Lard, Recipes and Revelations from a Legendary Life in Barbecue. And you can find links to their recipes for baby back ribs with a couple of those rubs they talked about and from scratch baked beans over at the Central Time Facebook page. It's Memorial Day weekend, and a lot of people will head to state parks to have fun on the holiday.
Coming up on Tuesday, we're going to have a guest on who will share her 10 favorite state parks, and you can help us get off to an early start thinking about all the state parks in Wisconsin.
Are you going to go to a state park this weekend? What is your favorite? Do you have a hidden gem? And what's your favorite time of year to go to Wisconsin's state parks? You can let us know over at the Central Time Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Your favorites.
It's interesting you brought up the seasons, because I do feel like I have preferences for different parks and different seasons. So for me, it's Big Bay State Park on Madeline Island in the summer. Mm-hmm. You know, that makes sense. It's northern Wisconsin.
Well, right, yeah.
Peninsula State Park, Door County in the fall, because the leaves in Door County are spectacular, and Kohler Andre anytime.
Yeah, I like Kohler Andre. I went through a list of state parks in Wisconsin. I was a little embarrassed at how many I still have to get to cross them off my list. Kohler Andre, I like. Natural Bridge State Park is the first one I went to in Wisconsin. I saw it on a map the day or two after I moved here. I thought, okay, sure, I'll drive over there. But Amnicon Falls I want to get to, and Aztalan, that's not far from us here. Still haven't been there.
We need to get out and go to more of these state parks. Yep. You're talking there. I'm thinking, yeah, I need to go to all those, too.
My Central Time is going to be on hiatus for the next month while we hit. Okay, it won't be. Unless our bosses are listening and could sign off.
I'll be on board with that.
All right, we'll probably be back. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.